Okay, I guess we'll get started. So today what I'm going to do is, first of all, I'm going to review real quickly the topics we covered on Wednesday about subspaces attached to a matrix and their dimensions of those subspaces. And then I'll do a long, well, not too long, but an extended example that's going to be very much like the problems on homework set 6. It's, and by the way, is due on Monday. Do in the sense that if you want to keep up with the course, you should do the problems by Monday. But of course, I've on WebAssign itself, I put the due date all the way at the end of the semester so that students can turn in their homework when they're able to. But to stay concurrent with the course, you should try to get those problems done by Monday. And I'll show you today how simple they are. And then we'll move on to a new topic, functions between vector spaces. And in fact, we'll specialize very quickly to a special family of functions called linear transformations, which you should come to understand as just as subspaces are very special subsets of a vector space. They behave well with respect to the vector space operations. So too, we'll be looking for functions that behave well with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. And those functions will be linear transformations. So I'll introduce that topic today. Actually, we'll spend most of next week talking about linear transformations. And then if you actually have been looking at the sequence of lectures or looking at the syllabus, you'll note that after we cover linear transformation, that's about when the second midterm is to occur. So what I'm thinking is that probably we'll spend next week on linear transformations, and there'll be a homework assignment associated with that. The following week, it's going to be spring break. So I'll have an exam then. No, the exam will occur the week after spring break, most likely. I've already had one request to not have it on the Friday after spring break. I think that's the 25th of March. So it could, but on the other hand, since I don't want to have it on the Monday after spring break, that's we do a review beforehand. That means there's a week before the review and the actual exam. So it could be that Wednesday, which I think is March 23rd, that could be a possible date for the second exam. But it could also, I could push it to the following week as well. But if I do that, then I'm just going to start covering new material that won't be explicitly on the second exam. But what will be covered up on the second exam will be the material up to linear transformations, I think. Okay, so any questions on that, where we're going? Okay, so on Wednesday I talked about ascribing subspaces to a matrix. There's three different ways we can do that, three standard ways anyway. Given a matrix with n rows and n columns, I'm going to not only tell you what the subspaces are, but how to find the bases, the sort of nice directions inside the subspace that are capable of reaching every point in the subspace in a unique way. We'll seek a linearly independent set of vectors such that when you look at all possible linear combinations, they actually generate the subspace in question. So what I'm going to do in the next series of slides is talk about the subspaces we can attach to a matrix and then how to find their bases. What I showed you on Wednesday is that to find a basis for any of these subspaces, the essential part of the calculation is to compute a reduced row echelon form of the matrix. So the first one is the row space of a matrix. It's the span of all the row vectors. So you can note each of these ordered lists of numbers I listed here are the entries of a row of a matrix. Then what you could do once you have these vectors, you can take all possible linear combinations. That's the span, and then it creates a subspace. If you notice the rows all have m components, that means each row vector is going to be an m-dimensional vector. And so the space that's generated by taking linear combinations of these guys is going to be live in the Rm, set of all ordered list of m numbers. Okay, so that's the subspace. And the way we find a basis for it is we take the matrix and we row reduce it to, it suffices to go to a row echelon form, but for some of these other subspaces, we have to go all the way to reduce row echelon form. So what I'm calling A double prime is the fully reduced version of the original matrix A, reduced row echelon form. And so the way we get a basis for the row space of A is we row reduce A to its row echelon form or reduced row echelon form and grab the non-zero rows. When you row reduce, you could end up with some zero rows at the bottom. Those are the rows you ignore. The non-zero rows are the ones you'll keep when you try to find a basis for the row space. All right, then we have the column space. Constructed in a similar way, we write all the column vectors, and then we take every possible linear combination of them. That creates a new subspace. But since the columns are going to have as many entries as we have rows, the column space of an n by m matrix is going to be a subspace of Rn. Now, when we row reduce the same matrix A to reduce row echelon form, we can use that calculation not only to find a basis for the row space, but also a basis for the column space. But it's not going to be the non-zero columns of the reduced row echelon form. Rather, the prescription for finding a basis for the column space is you go from A to its, say, its reduced row echelon form, and then here's where you'll have zero rows and you'll have columns with pivots, columns without pivots. We have we've analyzed matrices in row echelon form for a long time now. What we do here is we find the columns of the reduced row echelon form that have pivots. Now, if we were solving a system of linear equations, the columns of the reduced row echelon form that have pivots, they correspond to free variables. And so essentially, as soon as you find these columns, you're also you're finding the fixed variables. If a column contains a pivot, then it's a fixed variable. Columns without pivots are free variables. So effectively, we find the free variables here. And then what we do is we go back to the original matrix, A, and we grab the corresponding columns. And these columns of A will be sufficient to generate the entire column space of A. And moreover, they'll automatically be linearly independent, so they'll provide a basis. All right, so that row reduction calculation, taking A to A, is already determined real quickly, both a basis for the row space of A and a basis for the column space of A. And of course, the reduced row echelon form of A is also essential to finding a basis for the null space of A, that being the solution set of the set of linear equations that have A as a coefficient matrix. The way you find a basis for this subspace is, well, you solve the equations. And the only new thing you have to do is interpret those constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free parameters of the solution. Interpret those constant vectors as the basis vectors for this subspace. So as soon as you write down the solution of the linear system as a hyperplane, then you'll have a variable x, a free variable, say x3 times a certain constant vector, maybe another free variable x4 times a different constant vector. It's those constant vectors that are going to provide you with the basis for the null space. All right, so that's how we find bases. Let me supplement this by first of all, reviewing what the dimension of a subspace is. Well, these basis vectors, they're the number of independent directions you have in your space. So it's natural to think of them as representing the dimension. And indeed, that's the definition of the dimension of a subspace. It's the number of vectors you have in any basis. What's hidden in this definition are two theorems. The first theorem is that the number of vectors you have, well, first of all, every subspace has a basis, And the second theorem is that every basis for a given subspace has the same number of vectors. So because every subspace has a basis and every basis has the same number of vectors, we can ascribe the number of basis vectors as the dimension of any subspace. All right, now for the subspaces attached to a matrix, I've already shown you how to find the basis vectors. All we have to do now is count them. And so for the row space, we found a basis for the row space by getting a row echelon form of A and grabbing the non-zero rows. Well, a non-zero row is going to have a non-zero first entry, and so it's going to have a pivot in it. So in fact, the dimension of the row space is just the number of pivots in any row echelon form. But actually, that same number is the dimension of the column space of a matrix. Why? Well, the column, our recipe for finding a basis for the column space is to figure out where the pivots live in the row echelon form and go back to the original matrix and grab those columns. So for every pivot you have here, you're going to have a basis vector for the column space. So these two numbers are actually, the dimension of the row space is always equal to the dimension of the column space, because both are equal to the number of pivots in a row echelon form. All right, and so then lastly, we have the null space. Think of what it means to solve a linear system. We take the matrix, we row reduce it to reduce row echelon form, and then we expand our solution in terms of the free parameters. How many free parameters do we have? Well, as many as we have columns of the row echelon form that don't have pivots. So in fact, the dimension of the null space is going to equal the number of free parameters in the solution, which is going to equal the number of columns that don't have pivots. So here I'm counting the columns that do have pivots, and here the columns that don't have pivots. So from these numbers, what we find, first of all, is the row space and the column space, they, even though they live in different vector spaces, if you have A is equal to A11, A1m, AN1, ANM, just putting in the corner entries, this is an N by M matrix, the row space, well, it consists of M-dimensional vectors, so that's going to live inside the vector space Rm. The column space, each column is going to have as many entries as we have rows. And so the column space of A is going to be a subset of Rn. So these two subspaces live in different vector spaces if our row and column dimensions are differently. Yet, the hyperplane that they generate, that the actual subspace sitting inside whatever vector space contains it, they have the same dimension. So I have dimension of these two subspaces, even though they live in different vector spaces, is always the same. And the dimension of this guy, well, you can actually get it as soon as you know the dimension of either of these.
Is that because the dimension of the row space and the column space would be considered like unit vectors inside the subspace?
No, it's not because they're unit vectors. The reason is because we have a fixed number of columns, and it's a zero-sum game. Some of those columns are going to contain pivots, some are not going to contain pivots. And so when you add both of those numbers up, you get the total number of columns. But actually, you know, it's a very simple identity that just comes from this description of how we find the basis vectors. And once we got that recipe, it's simple to count how many vectors we're going to get. And then we see this identity, which is, this is going to become important later on next week when we talking about linear transformations. But suffice to say right now, it's just that we have these three subspaces attached to a given matrices, and there's relationships amongst their dimensions. The first two are exactly equal, and the third one, even if I didn't calculate this, I would know its dimension simply by knowing the dimension of, say, the row space. All I have to do is subtract from the number of columns of A the number of basis vectors of the row space, and then I'm left with the nullity. Okay, so that much is was meant to be a review of the things we talked about on Wednesday. What I wanted to do primarily start of lecture today is to work through an example, the kind of questions that are posed in WebAssign problem set 6, where you're typically given a matrix and you're asked to find a basis for the row space, a basis for the column space, let's list these things, a basis for the null space, and then we'll also find the dimension of the row space and the dimension of the column space, the so-called rank of A, and the dimension of this subspace, the null space, that's called the nullity of A. So the rank is the dimension of either one of these spaces, and the nullity is the dimension of the null space. But so let's proceed. What I'm giving you here in this problem is the meat of the calculation, the row reduction, where I take this matrix and I apply elementary row operations till I reach it, reduce row echelon form. That I'm not displaying in this example, but after the first exam, you're all supposed to know how to do the row reduction. Actually, prior to the first exam, you should know that. But so what I'm going to do, I simply assume, is that this 3x3 matrices row reduces to this matrix. That's the brunt of the calculation. What I'm going to do on this next series of slides is use this result to explicitly write down the basis for the row space, basis for the column space, et cetera. Okay, so this top line is nothing new. I'm just repeating my assumption of it, that A row reduces to a given matrix. Now, how do we get a basis for the row space of this matrix? I look at a row echelon form or the reduced row echelon form, and I see two non-zero rows. Those non-zero rows are going to be a basis for the row space. And so all I have to do is identify them, write them down, and put them inside a curly braces to indicate a set of vectors. So there's our basis for the row space. By the way, we can see that the row space is two-dimensional, right? Because we have two basis vectors. All right, what about the column space? Well, the same calculation, but just the end part of the calculation changes. Once we've row reduced A to a matrix in row echelon form, the recipe for finding a basis vector for the column space is to look at where the pivots live. So here's a pivot, there's the pivot. In this third column here, there is no pivot. You might want to try to put one there, but this is a zero entry. And pivots are always the first non-zero entries. So in fact, this matrix, the row echelon form, only has two pivots. If I go back to the original matrix, the first pivot in the first column, I'll grab that first vector. The second pivot in the second column means I grab the second column vector of A. And I use these first two columns as a basis for the column space. And again, it's two-dimensional. Why? Well, because we had two columns from which we were going to, we have two pivots that are going to lead us to two different columns of the original vector A. But what we should note is we have the same number of basis vectors as we have non-zero row vectors too. And so that's why the dimension of the row space is always the same as the dimension of the column space. All right, and then the null space. Okay, so here we have to do a little bit of extra work, but we're familiar with this business. If you have if you want to solve a linear system, you form the augmented matrix and you row reduce it to its reduced row echelon form. Well, what I gave you on the preceding slides was the reduced row echelon form of the coefficient matrix, not the augmented matrix. But there's very little difference between these two. If you know what the row echelon form of A is, then the row echelon form of A adjoined with the zero vector is just going to be the row echelon form of A adjoined with the zero vector. Because the operations that take A to this guy are not going to have any effect at all on this last column. All right, so what do we end up with? We end up with this augmented matrix in reduced row echelon form, which is the augmented matrix corresponding to the solution of the original linear system. So we stare at this guy and see that column one and column two, again, the columns with pivots, these are tied to the fixed variables in the solution. The third column has no pivot, so it's going to be associated with a free parameter, x3. I write down the equations corresponding to each row with this augmented matrix. I move the free variables over to the right-hand side. Now I have the fixed variables expressed in terms of free variables. I use these equations to write down a solution vector, substituting where I can for the fixed variables. And then finally what I do is I expand my solution vector in terms of the free parameters. So this vector is simply x3 times this constant vector. The constant vector is what we're after here. We're looking for a basis for the null space, and here it is. It's a single vector in this case. If we had two free parameters, then we would have had another vector to deal with. All right, so what happened here? Actually, we can also see that the dimension of the null space is one, because we only have one basis vector. Well, and then here we have a column with a pivot, column with a pivot. That common, since we have two pivots, the rank is equal to two. We have one column without a pivot. That means that the nullity, the dimension of the null space, is just going to equal one. And there's its basis vector. All right, so this kind of fell off the bottom, but this vector that kind of fell off the bottom of the page is exactly this, minus v, minus five, three, and one. All right, and then, the rank of A, which is either the dimension of the row space or the dimension of the column space, because I had two pivots in the row echelon form, the rank is two, and the nullity, it's the number of columns without pivots. We had a single column without a pivot in that row echelon form, so it's one. All right, all the problems on homework set sits, you're basically doing this analysis over and over again, and hopefully once you've done homework set six, you don't have to worry about this so much. It's pretty easy to do once you know what to look for. Okay, so any questions so far? Okay, so what I'm going to do in the remaining time today is introduce a new topic. The whole purpose of talking about subspaces was, well, up to the first exam, we developed some calculational tools. But after the first exam, what I've been concentrating on sort of filling out the mathematical framework of linear algebra. I began by talking about special sets, the so-called subspaces. And in fact, we never really consider sets that are any more complicated than subspaces in linear algebra. Well, the next thing, if you have sets, the next thing you might want to deal with mathematically is talk about functions between sets. How do you relate sets? And turns out, just as subspaces are very special kinds of sets, they're pretty simple kinds of sets as well, we'll be just as restrictive when we consider functions in linear algebra. We're only going to look at functions that are really well behaved with respect to the two fundamental vector space operations of scalar multiplication and vector addition. So first, let me just establish some nomenclature about functions. If you have a function from one set to another, we usually call the place where you start, the set at which you start, we usually call that the domain. And the set that you end up with after applying the function, we call that the codomain. So I introduced from the start just so that I can point to these sets and call them specific names. But here's the picture. A function is just a rule that for a given x inside your domain, it's a rule that identifies a unique element of your codomain. We indicate it by f applied to x. All right, so what am I going to talk about next is a very special family of functions where an x is a vector space, y is a vector space. So a linear transformation is going to be a function here are our vector spaces, ordered lists of M numbers and ordered lists of M numbers. And we'll see any function that takes an ordered list of M numbers and produces an ordered list of N numbers is going to be a linear transformation if it has the property that I can do scalar multiplication before or after I apply the function and I get the same result. Or, and I also, this is making sure that the function is well behaved with respect to scalar multiplication. Similarly, we're going to demand that the function is really well behaved with respect to vector addition, meaning I can add vectors and apply the function. But if I do that, I get the same result as if I applied the function to the individual vectors and then added them. So one thing you want to notice here is that maybe it's most obvious in the second case, this is vector addition, but it's occurring, you're adding m-dimensional vectors to one another. Over here, you're already landed in this target space, the codomain, and now you're adding n-dimensional vectors. So it's actually also in saying that and somehow the two fundamental operations between these two vector spaces are linked to one another. All right. And so I'll frequently refer to these two properties as saying linear transformations preserve scalar multiplication, meaning this identity holds, and they preserve vector addition, meaning this identity holds. All right, so one thing that's nice about linear transformations is to be a linear transformation, it has to behave well with respect to vector addition and scalar multiplication. When I take a linear combination of vectors, I do generally do both scalar multiplication and vector addition. And what's going to happen here is that if you have a linear transformation, not only is it going to behave well with respect to just doing vector addition or just doing scalar multiplication, sorry, that should have been multiplication, it's also going to behave nicely with respect to linear combinations of vectors. So let me show you what I'm saying here. Suppose we have V and maybe I'm expanding it in terms of some other vectors. Let's call it W and call it VC1 plus C2 V2 plus CK VK. So here's a particular vector that's represented as a linear combination of K other vectors. If T from say Rn, I use Rm to Rn, is a linear transformation, then what's going to happen is that T applied to W is going to be, well, T applied to C1 V1 dot 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 plus CK VK. But now, because linear transformations behave well with respect to vector addition, I can delay these vector sums. I can delay them until after I apply the transformation. So then I have a C1 V1 plus T C2 V2 plus, in similar terms, until I reach the last guy, plus CK. Plus T of CK times VK. But linear transformation also behave nicely with respect to scalar multiplication. So I can, in fact, pull out these constants as well. T V1 plus C2 T of V2 plus dot, 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 plus CK T of VK. So in some sense, linear transformations kind of distribute themselves over linear combinations. This is basically when you have a linear combination of vectors and you act on it by a linear transformation, you get another linear combination of vectors, which you could have obtained by applying the transformation individually to the vectors V1, V2, and V3, and then doing the scalar multiplication after you've figured out where V1 goes and where V2 goes. So that's displayed on this line. I state it as a lemma. if you have a linear combination of vectors and you apply a linear transformation, you end up with a linear combination, back virtually the same linear combination. You have exactly the same coefficients. It's just that B, the vectors Bi, have been replaced by their values rather than the vectors themselves. Okay. So, so those are the kind of functions we're going to be dealing with. I haven't yet given you an example of a linear transformation. Well, let me show you a couple things that are not linear transformations. First example, not a linear transformation. Let's take our favorite function from calculus. Say f, we'll think of it as a one-dimensional vector space going to a one-dimensional vector space, but the way I'll phrase it is that x is getting mapped to x squared. So this is function, very basic function you see very early on in calculus one, and it is what an example of a nonlinear function, right? Because we're squaring the variable rather than having it appear linearly. This is not going to be a linear transformation. So even if I interpret this as vectors like this, by putting it inside an ordered list, even though it has only one element, even this is not going to be a linear transformation because, for example, f of lambda x, well, what it should be is lambda x squared, which is going to be lambda squared x squared. On the other hand, lambda times the value of f at x is going to equal lambda times x squared. And because this is squared and this is not squared, they're not equal. And so even of the most non-trivial, first non-trivial function, first non-trivial polynomial is not a linear transformation. And of course, if I had cubes or if I had a sine function, if I had an exponential function, I could not use it to construct a linear transformation, even between these really simple vector spaces R1. However, if I had like 2x here, if I had a linear function, then in fact, it would work. If f was actually a linear function, then it would work. F of lambda x in this case would be 2 lambda x, 2 times lambda x. On the other hand, lambda times f of x, if this is the rule, would just be equal lambda times 2x. And these are the same. And so one basic idea that one, in order to generate examples of linear transformations, might be to try to generate this example, or generalize this example to higher dimensional spaces. But I actually chose a pretty special linear function here. If I change that slightly, suppose my function f sends x to 2x plus 1. Well, it's going to turn out that this constant term here is going to destroy it if I try to interpret this as a linear transformation, because f of lambda times x would end up being 2 times lambda x plus 1, wow, which is 2 lambda x plus 1, while lambda times f of x is going to be lambda times 2x plus 1. Is going to equal 2 lambda x plus lambda times 1 is 1. So these things are not equal. So it's almost right that the way we can create a linear transformation between two vector spaces is to use linear functions that map you from one to another. But in fact, we have to be even more restrictive. We can't allow any constant terms either. So then how in general are we going to set up a linear transformation? Well, first of all, what we need is a way of writing down a function between two vector spaces. So if t is going from Rn to Rm, let's think of points in this space as having coordinates x1 through xm, and they're getting sent, well, they're going to have to end up in an m-dimensional space. An n-dimensional space. And so what I'm going to need are a total of n components in the result here. So let's say the first component, let's call it, let me just call it f1. But it's got to depend on the variables in the domain. So it's going to depend on x1 through xm. But that's only the first component of the resultant vector. I need a second component, also depending on the original coordinates, xm. And we'll have similar components until we finally reach the total dimension of the codomain. Then we'd have a function fn depending on x1 through xm. And my statement here is that if these functions f1 through fm are all linear functions of their variables and they don't contain any constant terms, then this will be a linear transformation. But if I had anything more complicated for these component functions f1 through fn, anything more complicated, if it involved a sine function and it involved a cosine function, an exponential function, a square root, I would not get a linear transformation out of that. These are really special. By a linear function, so f is linear, if when you write it in terms of its variables, it looks like some number times the first variable plus some number times the second variable. In fact, what I'm writing down here is a linear combination of the variables, mxm. Now, for a linear function, I could also add in a constant here, and it would still be a linear function. But these things, these constant terms are not allowed. The constant term is not allowed for a linear transformation. But that's how you make them. You take linear functions of a given list of variables, and then you arrange them as a vector, and then however many components you have, however many functions you have, going to give you, you have one for each component, and that's going to give you a linear transformation from your original set of variables to however many components you want to include here. All right. So even this is not a very explicit example. Well, I'll give you an explicit example. If I had t of x1, x2 equals x1 minus x2, x1 plus x2, x2, this would be a rule that sends a two-dimensional vector to a three-dimensional vector. These component functions are all linear functions. They don't have constant terms. This will be a linear transformation. Okay. But in fact, even though this is a simple way to write down examples of linear transformations, this is usually not how they occur in linear algebra. I'm going to give you another construction of a linear transformation. Let's see if I. I sort of, as I was working on the blackboard, I worked my way a little bit ahead of the slides here. At this stage, I'm just talking about if I have a function between two vector spaces, I take two variables and it gets mapped to a three-dimensional variable. I have nothing but linear functions. Here, this is a linear function of t of s, this is a linear function of t of s, and this is a linear function of t of s. But because of that constant term, this particular function is not going to be a linear transformation. And I just show you the calculation that revealed that. When you do the scalar multiplication of this function, you do the scalar multiplication before, you get one result, but the constant in the last component is one. If you delay the scalar multiplication till the very end, that constant term in the last component turns out to be the scalar multiple, not one. So this is not a linear transformation. But here's the example I wanted to get to. This is the most common way that we're gonna see linear transformations inside linear algebra, is that we can attach a matrix to them. Actually, the attachment, the creation of a matrix corresponding to a linear transformation is something I'm going to cover on Monday. Today, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to show you, given an n by n matrix, how do I construct a linear transformation? So let's start with a matrix with m columns and n rows. And what I'm going to do is I have a vector with m components, then AX is defined. M components here because for this product to be defined, I'm multiplying an n by m matrix times a column vector m by 1, I've got the match that I need. And what's going to get kicked out by this is a column vector with n components and, n rows in a single column. All right, so what I want you to see here is that via matrix multiplication, I can take a list of m numbers and I can produce a list of n numbers. And in fact, that's exactly the way we create a linear transformation. Okay, here's the matrix multiplication. What I do is I'll define a linear transformation corresponding to this matrix by saying that its action on a given m-dimensional vector is going to be the vector that's produced when I do matrix multiplication. So what's going to happen if I have an m-dimensional column vector being multiplied from the left by an n by m matrix, it's going to produce an n by 1 column vector or an n-dimensional vector. And so I get a map that takes me from m-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. That's a function, and it's easily seen to be a linear transformation because scalar multiplication commutes with matrix multiplication. So here I'm applying the definition of this function. In the middle, I'm using the fact that matrix and scalar multiplication commutes with matrix multiplication. And then I'm identifying A of X as just being T subscript A of X. And I get the identity I want. Scalar multiplication before applying the function yields the same result as when I delay the scalar multiplication until after I apply the function. And for preservation of, or the conservation of vector addition, that's also clear from this for this function, because when I apply the function to a sum of vectors, that's the same thing, according to this definition, as multiplying the sum of these two vectors from the left by a matrix A. But that matrix multiplication is going to distribute over this sum, and then I see that I get the result of applying this function to a sum of vectors is equal to a sum of the values of the two vectors. Okay, so I think what I'll do is stop with the theory here. We'll delay that until next week. But what I want to do, sort of leave you with before we get back to this stuff on Monday, is showing you why we're interested in linear transformation. Further down the road, because it turns out these linear transformations, that's one of the reasons why you're in linear algebra. So so here I'm just looking ahead. So we've been talking about ordered lists of numbers as being a basic vector space. I've always concentrated on this because this is your calculational arena. even when you consider more general objects that you want to regard as vector spaces. So this is our basic calculational vector space. But in the first week of class, I told you that there are other things that behave like vectors. And so an example of a more general vector space is the following. I'll make it a rigorously defined set, but that's, you know, the rigor here just so I can take derivatives. So if I have a set of functions on the real line that for which I can take as many derivatives as I want, that also is it has the structure of a vector space. Well, how so? It doesn't look anything like an ordered list of numbers. But what's important here is that if you have a function inside this set, then there's a notion of scalar multiplication. Lambda times f is going to be a new function, and it's going to be defined as being the function whose value at x is just lambda times the value of the input function. So this is creating a new function from an old function by doing scalar multiplication. And similarly, if you have a sum of functions, if you have two functions, you can create a new function that's called the sum of f and g, and it's just, its values are just going to be the sum of the values of f and g. So my claim, and this will become clearer at the end of the course, is that this set is a vector space in an abstract sense just as much as this. It's a set where I have both scalar multiplication and vector addition well defined. What I want to show you is a linear transformation on this set. I claim the derivative operator that takes you from differentiable functions to differentiable functions is a linear transformation. When I think of these guys as vector spaces, why? Because when you take the derivative of a constant times a function, you just get the constant times the derivative of that function. So it does behave well with respect to scalar multiplication. And when you take the derivative of a sum of functions, well, you can just differentiate term by term. And you get df dx plus dg dx. So in fact, this notion of linear transformation is going to allow, once we expand our horizons to consider more general vector spaces, they're going to occur naturally in sort of a surprising way. Now we're suddenly talking about objects in calculus as being governed by linear algebraic rules. And in fact, that's the whole major point of this course, is that in fact, everything you learned in Math 2233, elementary linear algebra, particularly when you get to linear differential equations, is really most aptly handled using linear algebra. And that's coming up. But what I want to leave with you today is just the fact that these linear transformations, functions between vector spaces, they're really crucial. They're really crucial to the utility of linear algebra. In fact, what we'll end up, I'll show you later on, that when you try to solve differential equations, basically what you're trying to do is figure out how to deal with that linear transformation. And as long as you're dealing with a finite dimensional space, you can handle a differential equation as if it were a matrix, and you're working with a matrix. Okay, so that's all coming down the road. I'll stop here. Wish you a happy weekend, and I'll see you again on Monday.